Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, a podcast which is ostensibly a books podcast in a book of the week format, but which recently has used book selection to backdoor our way into discussion of a couple of different mediums. And we are today talking about a novel about film, Paul Auster's The Book of Illusions, along with two other novels that we've discussed on the podcast, which I'll bring in momentarily. So Paul Auster's The Book of Illusions is a novel which follows Professor Paul Zimmer, a literature professor who loses his wife and two sons, which is to say his whole family, in an airplane crash, following which he finds his only comfort in the silent films of the actor and director Hector Mann. So Zimmer becomes the foremost academic advocate of Mann's work, writes a definitive study, and that attracts the attention of Mann's wife. I can't remember actually who contacts him, but he's contacted by folks connected to Mann who has been thought dead since the 1930s, but actually has been alive and living in an isolated place, making movies entirely for himself. So Mann is on the verge of death. All his films will be burned when he dies. Zimmer travels with a woman named Alma to Hector's ranch. During the trip, Alma explains to Paul the way that Hector ended up where he is now, which is essentially that Hector, you know, was indirectly responsible for the death of a woman he was involved with, and fled, and out of guilt, renounced making films for anyone other than himself. So Zimmer travels with Alma to Hector's ranch and is able to see one of Hector's films before Hector dies, and all the films he's ever made are burned by his wife Frida in alignment with his wishes. Now, Paul returns to New York planning to begin a life with Alma, but in his absence, Mann's widow burns the only copy of Alma's biography of Hector, which results in Alma killing her in a struggle, and then Alma is so upset by that and by the loss of her manuscript that she kills herself. And at the novel's end, Zimmer reflects on his certainty that Alma must have saved some copies of Hector's secret films and of his hope to one day find those copies. Now, I read The Book of Illusions back in, I think, 2010, give or take. And during this podcast, just a few months ago, back, I think, in November, we discussed Theodore Rorschach's 1991 novel, Flicker. And Flicker reminded me in certain ways both of The Book of Illusions and... Sorry, what did you say, Patrick? Oh yeah, Flicker by Theodore Rorschach. I did really enjoy that novel. That was a very good choice. Kudos on your pick there, Patrick. I should say, by the way, I'm Hans Berger, one of the two hosts of the Book Spider podcast, along with Patrick Barney, whose voice you've already heard, and Chris Malmberg. Anyway, so back in November, we read Flicker. And Flicker reminded me in certain ways of The Book of Illusions. And it also reminded me of another book that we'd read for this podcast, Steve Erickson's Zeroville, which was published in 2007. And I wouldn't have connected Book of Illusions and Zeroville on their own. I read Book of Illusions in 2010 and Zeroville in, I think, about 2017-ish, the first time. I wouldn't have read Book of Illusion and Zeroville. I wouldn't have connected those separately. But Flicker sort of, it seemed to straddle themes and plot points from both of those books. And in my mind, I began to think of Book of Illusion, Flicker, and Zeroville as kind of an unofficial trilogy, right? In the sense that they are all novels about a protagonist whose dedicated study of film gradually reveals some kind of underlying reality, whether that reality is mystical or more just kind of like the fate of an individual. And all three are narrated in ways which kind of shift from a conventional realism into a less definable register that you might call surrealistic or filmic. So I thought it would be interesting to talk about all three of those books in conjunction. But to do that, we do have to start with Book of Illusions, right? Because that's the one that we haven't really discussed on the podcast. And I wanted to begin by talking about whether or not we think of Book of Illusions as a realist film, or film, Jesus Christ. I'm going to be doing that all podcast. I did that in Flickr. I'm going to be doing that here too, right? Which I think is to some extent, you know, Rorschach and Auster and Erickson would be fine that I made that mistake. But Book of Illusions, there's nothing in it that is overtly supernatural or surreal. And, you know, it still felt in some way like a slightly heightened version of reality, right? Like something that's not quite from our world. So I said in the intro that it wasn't a realist novel, but I'm struggling a little bit to define the ways in which it isn't. So where does that sense come from? Or am I the only one who had that sense? You know, I read that. I did not even remotely think that. I did not even remotely think that when I was reading this book, either of the two times that I've read it. And then last night I read a New Yorker article that was really quite mean to Auster, somewhat convincingly, I think. I read a New Yorker article about all the ways in which Auster is not a good novelist. And it confidently asserted. Okay. Oh, good, good. Okay, good, good. I'm glad, but the New Yorker article, which I should pull that up here so I have it for reference. It confidently asserted that it is all a delusion, and I 100% did not have that sense. And so I'm wondering what is the clue for that? What's that based on?
When he first discovers Hector Mann's silent comedy films, one of them makes him laugh, and he expresses pleasure that he is able to laugh. Like, he's, you know, his wife and two children are dead, he's in terrible grief, but this film is still able to make him laugh, right? So that then later, when he meets Hector Mann for the first time at his ranch, Hector says something similar about Auster's own work on Hector Mann. Like, it made me laugh, and that really made me interested. I feel like there was at least one other similarity like that. I don't quite remember what it was, but I feel like there was at least one other similarity where a thing that occurs to Zimmer occurs to one of the characters. And then also the fact that at the end, what's Zimmer's love interest's name again? Alma dies in a suspiciously similar situation to Hector's, like, the woman that he's, like, using for sex, Brigida? Bridget. And so, like, or rather, Frida Spelling die. Like, the deaths surrounding Frida Spelling and Alma kind of mimic or mirror the death of Bridget. So those uncanny resemblances gave me this sense of hyper realism that you're talking about. And then kind of so I was like, something more is going on, right? But what cinched it for me in the belief that everything after the accident is a figment of his nervous breakdown was the fact that at the end, he turns up with no evidence whatsoever that Hector Mann lived past his disappearance. Like all the films are burned. Everyone who knew him has disappeared or is dead. He has no evidence whatsoever, which you would absolutely expect if this is a figment of his imagination. And therefore, when he has a talk with the fan group of Hector Mann, they ask him, you know, were you able to find out what happened to him? Why did he disappear? And he's like, no, I wasn't able to find anything. Also, like, the title, The Book of Illusions, I'm not sure what other illusion it would be referring to if it's not the illusion of his belief in Hector Mann, unless it's just referring to, like, film itself as illusory or an illusion.
Well, I definitely want to give you a little bit of space to linger on that, right? Because I want to get into what it was that you thought was awesome about it, because I don't know, like, I like to like things, right? I think that it's funny that it never occurred to me that it might be that we might just be meant to understand that the events he narrates are not literally occurring in his reality, because we on this podcast read the New York trilogy, which does a version of the same thing, right? You have two novellas, and then the third novella reveals that the first two novellas were a product of the imagination of the writer who is narrating the third novella. And I think, you know, the article that I was referring to is Shallow Graves by James Wood. The title of the article is Shallow Graves, and James Wood is the critic who was writing The New Yorker. And I think one of his concerns, I have not read an enormous amount of Auster's work, and at least one of the things that I have read, I have almost entirely forgotten. I think his point essentially was that his work has some of the same effect that maybe like Murakami's does, right? Where the first couple that you read, whichever the first couple Auster novels that you happen to read are, they are very impressive. And then if you attempt to kind of digest his whole bibliography, it begins to seem repetitive in ways which dull the impact of any individual work, right? And Wood makes the point that the particular trick of 80% of the way through the novel, you realize that the bulk of the story is, somehow a projection, a fantasy, a novel within a novel. That's just a thing he does a lot, right? It's not just New York Trilogy and Book of Illusions. And at some point, the trick is less impressive through repetition. And I should say, like, I really like I really like New York Trilogy a lot, and I have pretty positive feelings about Book of Illusions, but I can see how maybe it would begin, you know, anytime you have an author who uses certain tricks repetitively, on the kind of scale of a whole body of work, they become less impressive. Patrick, do you want to just kind of talk for a while about what it was you found impressive about this, why you enjoyed it so much?
Probably I liked it probably for the same reasons that I really enjoyed Flicker and Zeroville. Like, they're all novels about dudes geeking out about film, right? Like, they own each of the characters has their own, like, neuroses, and like the main character of Flicker, is his neuroses is that he, like, has no personal identity other than, like, what other people give him, which is interesting. But yeah, like, just the interest in film, the, like, clear love of film techniques, and I also, you know, a thing that I really love in all art is art within art. All three of those novels have it. I just think it's a super cool, like, fun thing. Like, I don't know why, but I remember from our class Forms of Fiction back in graduate school, there was a story by Chekhov called Gooseberries, where there's a story within a story that what's her name? The instructor, Jerry Brightwell, kept calling an interpolated story. But that's just a technique that I enjoy a lot. Like, I don't know, and I wouldn't be able to say exactly why I enjoy it. I think in Book of Illusions, it that technique worked really well. And Zeroville and Flicker, just as a way of, like, kind of engaging with how film has invaded is a seems like a negative word, but invaded our psyches, or kind of come into our psyches, and in the best case scenario, kind of improved human consciousness, and like you said in one of your questions, like a source of solace in a cold and brutal world. I liked all the characters of all three novels, so yeah, I mean, just basic stuff, really.
I think that the way that I felt about Book of Illusions, you know, it's such a dramatic novel, right? In the sense that, like, there's so much, particularly if you're reading it without understanding that it's meant to be processed as a delusion, the kind of rhyming, nested tragedies, the ways that these moments of intense drama and suffering and death kind of keep following both of these characters around, Hector Mann and Paul Zimmer, and sort of replicating themselves, the ways that that people's lives always sort of, like, build up to these, like, intense moments of catharsis and trauma. That, for me, I think kind of rests on this knife edge where it can tilt over into melodrama and absurdity, or it can be compelling, right? And I, especially when I read it the most recent time, I wasn't quite sure which side that I fell on, right? But I do think that really the like you said, the ways in which it functions as geeking out about film, I did like that a lot. And I thought that the invented, interpolated movies, particularly within Book of Illusions, were very well crafted, and it was a bit just like watching movies, right? And I think it's, you know, you talked about liking it when this happens. It's very hard to pull off, and lots of interpolated things. It's tricky because you have to make something that is good enough to support its narrative weight, right? If the invented Hector Mann films that are described in the book sound like bad movies, then it calls the whole sort of thing, it's like the Rent effect, right? Like, you know, in Rent,
or the pale fire problem,
right?
Yeah, it's the challenge of basically saying, like, this is a great work in a very different medium, so it better be fucking good.
It's like a double challenge as a writer, because you have to write both a really good poem and a really good novel. And yeah, I mean, and I think that fiction is, because it is a, like, fiction is the medium in which the most can be done with the littlest resource, right? Like, fiction is the medium in which you can give someone the most immersive and intense experience, and the most, I think, the biggest range of immersive, intense experiences. You can do that with essentially no resources, right? You it's not like, you can take all the art forms and kind of put them on a spectrum from most resource intensive, which is probably film, to least resource intensive, which is, you know, the verbal arts, right? Like poetry, or the linguistic arts, like poetry, fiction. But fiction, I think it has this particular quality where it can do the immersive, if you have, you know, a capable, smart reader, it can do the immersive world building of film with the budget of poetry. And I think for that reason, it is uniquely capable of bearing, you know, an interpolated film that is described, an interpolated, even like a sculpture that is described, or, you know, having a poem nestled within it. It's one of the, I don't know that it's talked about that often, but it's one of the secret talents of fiction to contain other art forms. And I think, you know, the first time that I read all of these books, I remember thinking, like, is there a white flag quality here where, like, fiction is admitting itself to be a lesser art form by kind of serving as an extended tribute to movies in a way that I can't really ever imagine a movie functionally serving as an extended tribute to fiction, right? There are movies about writers, but I don't think any of them really, like, capture writing and fiction in the same way that this fiction captures movies. But in fact, I think rather than coming from a submissive posture, I think what these books are actually doing is secretly making a case for the power and strength of fiction by kind of engulfing and representing the world of film in a way that couldn't be done in reverse.
I like that. I like that. It feels a bit like something that would maybe be, I don't know if it would actually be something that would be on Paul Auster's mind while, like, writing the Book of Illusions, but it feels like an element in the Book of Illusions that, I don't know, I don't think I got there by myself without you saying it. Now, I loved the first, and I haven't read the James Wood critique. I loved this book, and then I hated it.
Why?
I felt the heavy hand of plot for me, and I'm not sure exactly like what. Like, I wondered in the moment when everything was going to shit at the end of this book, if Paul Auster was just like, fuck, I am not telling 10 other plot, you know, I'm not telling the story of 10 other fucking movies. Like, I don't have it in me. And so, you know, fuck this. This is ending too happily. There's like too much opportunity for grace at the end of this. I have to like burn it all down. I really hated it. I think I hated it in direct sort of like relation to how much I fucking adored this book up to The Ranch and basically Hector dying, and it wasn't even like I already was upset, you know, like with what happens at that point in time, like okay, like we have to just sort of like appreciate this last film, which I thought was okay, you know, like I liked it, but you get the titles of these other films, and the titles are fucking fascinating. And then it's like real cock tease shit where you're just like, you know, no, we're not gonna hear about those. Those get to go away. I was already upset about that, and upset that like it felt like the trajectory of the novel was kind of getting to this really interesting apotheosis. And it honestly felt to me like Auster couldn't pull it off. And so it was just sort of, let's like nosedive down into like kind of a despair, but he has to go one little bit further and basically, you know, sort of like suggest at the end that Frida is, you know, like was sort of Frida murdered Hector and everything. And it felt, you know, It's so, I don't know how to reconcile it. I'll add another clue to this is all an illusion. I mean, that final movie is all about basically an illusion in the act of writing, you know, that the muse and the sexual relationship that is struck up between the writer and his muse. And then he chooses her over his work. I can see that maybe being another little clue that like there's that this is all a delusion, but it's so hard for me to kind of like make that work in my brain with the frame for this novel, which is, you know, 11 years have gone by and he's not, you know, there's not to me like he's either an truly unreliable narrator, or I missed all of the hints that he's dropping that this is kind of a metaphor for his journey out of despair. But I really fucking hated the end of this book. But it's 11 years have gone by, and he's like, has he, you know, I don't know how to make that work. In my head, why would that be how this is written? Like to strain to put that much strain on the kind of like illusory nature of it, to say like 11 years have gone by and this is what happened, but it's an illusion. Like, I don't know why you would do that. I feel like I think 11 years, if 11 years goes by, it just puts a strain on that aspect of it. Like, why would that be how this is framed? Because, like, if 11 years have gone by, you would want his relationship to the illusory nature of it to have evolved in some way that comments on the illusory nature of it. And I didn't feel that. Like, I didn't feel that at all. It felt, Murakami's a good example, you know, not just because there's, like, strange little people running around, but the decisions at the end felt necessary to end it, and in a way that like was deeply unsatisfying to me. So I don't know, maybe I can't really look past the harshness of my critique to like appreciate whether this was illusion or not. I was like telling Mare, like, oh, this book is amazing. This is awesome. Like, I love this book. And then, like, it just fell off a cliff. And I think it does have to do with a little bit the, you know, what at a kind of like a larger sort of thematic level, like some of those craft choices at the end are trying to do. And I just don't know how to organize them in a way that like gives me any pleasure at all, or makes me think in a, you know, makes me think in a way that like I find interesting. It's just it's not even mean. It was just sort of like, I don't know. I'll get off my soapbox.
I just want to understand a little bit better. So you felt like the wrapping up of the plot, starting when we get to the ranch, is kind of contrived. It doesn't work very well. And you think the frame doesn't make sense with the idea that it's a delusion, right? Well, if it's not a delusion, I would agree that the plot at the end is contrived because there are so many similarities to like things that have happened already, which is why I think it's a delusion. But anyway, go on.
I'm not sure where else I would take it. I think that what is it? Kiss of the Spider Woman. I love the interpolated story, like kind of like relaying the plots of films and having those be sort of a mirror on the character or narrator who's sort of like doing that telling and remembering. And there is a lot about in this that is kind of like remembering, you know, if you think about like how the many ways in which like the stories refracted between people, and then you know, so like Alma is telling the story of, you know, Hector Mann to the narrator who's reciting it to us, you know, after 11 years, you know, so like, and then he happens upon a notebook, a journal of Hector Mann's that like reaffirms everything. And it does feel very, very contrived to basically like, to make it feel like Hector's life is very unrealistic. And this goes back to your original question, Hans, like Hector's life is like stupendously amazing and an incredible story. And seems unbelievable, and then like there's a lot of work that's invested in sort of the texture of the story to like, not the texture, but like sort of like corroborating like evidence to make it believable, and that too, I don't know why you would do that if the whole thing is an illusion. Maybe it shows the illusory nature of it because there is like this hint in the story that things need to be corroborated, but it feels like there's just a lot of unnecessary moves around that like thematic like point, if that is a thematic point.
Everything you're saying tells me I'm right.
Well, it's fine.
I don't mean to be like a jerkball.
No, you be a jerkball.
The way you talk about how it's contrived, like if I thought this were meant to be taken as real within the universe, I'd be on board with what you're saying. I'm like, yeah, this is contrived BS. Like this is garbage. But the very fact that it's so contrived and there's all this like crosstalk between the different similar things happening in different stories and the reflection, it all just makes me think more and more that it's a delusion. And like, I do see what you're saying about, and you know, if you don't like that it's a delusion, yeah, I get it. Like if you thought that was dumb, cool. Yeah, I understand that. Like, I might think the same thing in other situations, like in different books, if it turned out to not be real, I'd be like, this is bullshit, you know? The first time I saw Jacob's Ladder, and at the end it's revealed that like all this is hit. Well,
yeah.
Spoilers. Have you guys seen Jacob's
Spoilers,
Ladder?
Spoilers, but yes, I've seen it.
Spoiler, everyone. You know, at the end it's all a figment of his dying brain. I was like, this is fucking garbage. Then I rewatched it a couple times. I'm like, oh, this is a really good movie. And you know, so like I get your response, and I do like I do think I see like, you know, like the gripe about it being 11 years, like 11 years later, and he still kind of hasn't come out of this, like if it is a delusion and it's 11 years later. And I'm just not quite certain that I think that is unbelievable. Like, it seems to me possible for a psyche to construct false memories. Like, it's very rare. Like, false memories are super rare in psychology.
I think I'm less concerned about the reality of it. I think, like, it's a novel. Like there's like a lot of like leeway that we can, that I'm very willing to give it, actually. Like, I don't really like, it's not the a problem with a suspension of disbelief. It's a problem of like, what is it actually doing? Like, why would you take an illusion that has not evolved in 11 years and tell it from 11 years later, rather than like experience it in the moment? Or, you know, why, you know, and I it's to the extent that it feels sort of, and I so adored this novel, and I really like, I really wanted to like it, and I would be fine with it being an illusion. I just, like, there's a whole, like, the whole final fifth of the book to me feels like a very bombastic and spectacular ending that is meant to be like extremely emotional and mute at the same time. And it just, all of the colors get muddled together, and it kind of just ends up blah for me. And for a book like this to end that way is just a kind of a tragedy.
I do think the more that we talk about it, Patrick, I think you're right. And I...
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't like that you're right.
Is it because you... Why don't you like that I'm right?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's just because I like mysteries more than answers.
Oh, all right.
If it's a novel where everything... It's funny because, like, talking about this, it's strange to me that I didn't pick up what is probably being put down here, right? Or that I didn't really kind of think to question the reality of the novel, because the habit that we've talked about of these kind of rhyming, nested, melodramatic catastrophes that did feel unrealistic to me at the time that I was reading it, but I didn't... It just didn't ever occur to me that maybe the narrator is making it up, right? Or experiencing it as a delusion. I wonder if maybe to some extent that had to do with residue from how we had talked about Flicker, right? Because one thing that we talked about with Flicker was that novel has a similar way, not totally similar, but a not dissimilar way of starting in what feels like a very grounded reality and gradually kind of moving into this sort of air of fantastic remove. And the way that we described that and diagnosed that when we talked about it was that it was almost like it was moving from like a novel into a film, right? That it was gradually seeping into a filmic register. And I think that I had the remainder of that, I had that interpretive lens sort of stuck over my eye like a, you know, monocle that your eyebrow grows around.
Cool simile.
Would have been better if I hadn't choked immediately afterward, but particularly talking about lenses when we're discussing film, I suppose. I think that if anything, I thought that maybe the over-the-top quality of the events and the odd kind of repetitiveness of the sort of repeated spin up into tragedy, I just thought that maybe that was somehow meant to be, again, happening in a filmic register, and that there was some meta quality to that. But I wasn't really able to figure out how to put that into a meaningful aesthetic or thematic structure, right? Because it's not really a book about that kind of movie. So I think actually, yeah, your point makes total sense and is a better way of explaining it. But on some level, it feels like maybe a little bit more pedestrian way of explaining it. To the Chris, to your question about why it's been 11 years and he still hasn't budged from his delusion, I think that's a way of showing us how important and central this delusion is to his whole emotional identity and personality and well-being, right? Like, this delusion was his way of processing and moving out of tragedy. And I suppose on some level to let go of the reality of it maybe is to feel the fear of lapsing back into it, right? Like the very last paragraph in the novel, he talks about his hope, his true deep hope that the remaining films have not been lost and are out there somewhere and someone is going to find them. And the last sentence in the story is, I live with that hope. And I suppose, you know, the point of 11 years passing is to tell us that the time since this delusion, it has been the support that has, you know, he's stood on to get out of tragedy. And the hope is in some way still what he lives on and with. And so now, is that credible? I don't really think so. I mean, I've only ever personally known one person who had delusions, and they were deeply and profoundly disorganized, right? Like, is there record in psychiatry of someone having a contained instance of extended hallucination or an incredibly vivid dream that they were unable to, that they could recall in every exacting little detail and could not tell from waking reality because of the frailty of their psychic state? If there is, I'm not aware of it. And whatever experience I've had with, you know, this type of delusion suggests that it tends to come in, like, it's much more kaleidoscopic, right? So I don't necessarily find it plausible, even to the extent that, you know, there's, anytime you're dealing with books or movies about delusion, you know, there's a kind of suspension of disbelief. And maybe I partly don't like it because it feels unrealistic on that level. But I don't know. I think if I don't like it, it's because it just feels a bit tidier. It tidies the experience I was having with the novel. And I think the feeling of that sense of mystery was a little more satisfying to me than having a tidy bucket to put things in.
Hell yeah. Ruined another one for you guys.
Patrick, why, and Hans, why is it that you think that the delusion starts with the car accident? Is it because it just all, the rest of it takes place over a couple days? Is that what it is, or?
Because the car accident is the first point at which things occur that cannot be independently verified.
Uh-huh.
Other than the letters. I guess the letters are maybe a thing that cannot be independently verified, but they're kind of isolated.
I was thinking that my original thought was that the first, he receives one letter and then another one, and then so he receives a letter, then he sends one back wanting verification, and then he receives another one saying, like, please hurry, right? And then he sends another letter saying, I need verification, and then it's like 2 weeks, right? Isn't that the chronology?
Yeah.
So the two letters could be real and just crank letters. Is what I guess that's what I thought. I thought the letters were real, just crank letters. And then, you know, like he, because there's this long 2 weeks between the last letter and the arrival of Alma, and like the letters really work him up, like really put him into a frenzied state, make him kind of freak out. So yeah, maybe the letters are real, maybe they're not. I'm not quite sure.
And I guess if we think of the letters as being a real thing that spurs the delusion, that little bit of mechanism I guess, does make everything hang together a little bit more neatly. I still don't love it, but I don't know. Like, I have such mixed feelings about this book, right? And I think I've had a less intense version of what you experienced, Chris, where I, at various times, I've been very admiring of it and very critical of it. And I am somewhat capable of being swayed, I think, by a strong opinion in one direction or the other, which is maybe, I don't know, maybe that's to its credit, right? If it can inspire that kind of ambivalence.
It's just, I've never heard that before. This the ambivalence being the thing that it seeks to generate.
Well, it's it's like in Zeroville, right? Like, I hate this movie. I hate this movie. Oh, I love this movie. There's a version of that here that I've had, but it's much less durable, right? Like, I kind of pitch back and forth. So, bringing it in, I don't know, actually, with the references we've already made to Flicker and Zeroville, I don't necessarily know if there's too much else to, I don't know if there's too much else to say about the relationship between them, right? I mean, I think that, like, we all agree that all three are very effective as kind of documents of the love of film in ways that are very affecting and interesting, and that they're these kind of tributes to the love of the art of film that I think are good, partly as a way of showing how fiction as a medium can encompass and encapsulate and convey other artistic forms in a way that I don't think any other artistic form is capable of. I do think it's interesting how resonant the plots are with each other between these three books, right? So, like, Book of Illusions and Flicker both are about an academic studying the work of a dead filmmaker who turns out to be alive but living in a hidden place, creating masterpieces for no audience but himself, right? Even though, you know, in one book it's voluntary isolation, in the other it's captivity. Still, like, that's such a, I don't know, I don't have any evidence or any way of knowing if Auster read Flicker, right? And Flicker, I think, was published in 91, Book of Illusions in 2010, so, or sorry, 2002, rather. So, I don't know if Flicker was an influence on Book of Illusions, but there's definitely a pretty strong plot resonance, right? And Flicker and Zeroville both have plots in which a number of films are found to contain some kind of hidden or encoded content, and discovering that upends the protagonist's sense of reality. So it's almost like Flicker is this sort of ur-text of, you know, surreal film geek novel that, you know, like, Erickson sort of Ericksonizes Flicker and Auster kind of Austerizes Flicker. I don't know that either one of them read it, and I certainly don't mean to say that that Book of Illusions and Zeroville are, like, derivative works, right? I don't think that they're derivative, and I don't think they're weakened by seeing that relationship, but I just think it's interesting how certain ideas and images and plots kind of recur between the three books, right? So, I don't know. Is there anything to get out of that resonance?
I think that, like, it's like you're suggesting, it's not maybe necessary for Erickson or Auster to have read Flicker. Maybe because some of these things are sort of fundamental to film, right? So, for as long as film has been around, like, there's been this idea of, like, embedded information in a way that it's really hard to imagine embedded information. I guess, like, there's embedded or hidden information in text, but it's not subliminal, usually, I don't think, in the way that it's portrayed, in the way that film, you know, especially with Flicker, like where there's information that is actually acting on people, Zeroville. I can't remember if the I did not reread that for this, but I don't remember if the little frames that are inserted in film reels are doing anything to people or if they're just there to be discovered. They're just there. But like I think that sort of thing has sort of piggybacked film for a long time. And then with film two, there is, I think the same problem, but different now, the way that information can degrade or be lost. But film is, film degrades in a way that text can't. So it feels also like, or it's very hard to, a book can like be like submerged in water and be almost totally destroyed. But if it's the last book of its kind and you can still read it, you know, it's still there. But like, you know, if film is left, you know, on the wrong shelf in a slightly humid, you know, building for a couple decades, it's just not going to be watchable. So like there's a way in which film also lends itself to stories of work that is lost and work that has disappeared, even like extraordinarily like respected work at the time, like Molière or whoever. Like it feels like those are things that are kind of embedded in film as a medium, and so probably stories about, you know, like people going through old filmic work necessarily like engages with those, like what's hidden in these films, and then the act of finding them or like preserving them, because so much has been lost.
I think that's very articulately stated, and that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and I think also maybe there's embedded a little bit in film is the idea, like the artistically ambitious director is almost always in some way a somewhat tragic figure, right? Because film is so unique in that the need to create it, or the act of creating it, involves this need to marshal really astonishing resources, even for a fairly low budget, you know, film. And so it almost every director who's been artistically ambitious has in some way been suppressed by the economics of film, right? Orson Welles basically made one movie that was completely realized as a statement, and then a whole bunch of things that were crippled and watered down, and he was just kind of constantly in this fight against the economics of the studio system and the logistics of actually creating the things that he wanted to create, right? And there's some version of that for essentially every great director, even somebody like David Lynch, who had an amazing body of work and all the admiration you'd ever want and a beautiful house in Hollywood, still at some point had to say, like, I am not allowed by the economics and logistics of the studio system to keep making things that implement my vision, right? And so I think like the idea of the director as a somewhat tragic figure sort of pervades at least Flickr and Book of Illusions, maybe not in ways that are like obviously references to the lives of Welles or Tarkovsky or Lynch, but that are, I think in there's kind of a way, there's a way that that history informs how we think about the idea of the art film director that is very different from how we might think about a poet or a writer or, you know, most musicians or whatever, where there's just not the same sense of having to kind of struggle against this mammoth capitalist bureaucracy to even make a thing.
One other thing that occurred to me, I'm I'm playing a bit of telephone from a conversation I had with someone over 10 years ago. So like, I'm going to fuck this up. But I spoke with a guy, Nick Susanis, who's a comics and education thinker. He's an education blogger and person who writes about education, and he's also a comic artist. So like, he's somewhat well known for that in that very particular niche, I guess. But like, I spoke to him for something that I was working on at the University of Alaska Fairbanks when I used to work there. And he was talking about comics and education, and he talked about, I think he was saying that it was a Plato thing, but I can't remember, about a very fundamental sort of idea that we have about writing versus visual, written versus visual information, and that like we are at a kind of like cultural like level, like a like in, you know, deep in our sort of like the marrow of our culture, we believe that text tells the truth, but visuals lie, and he traced that back to one of the kind of classic philosophers, and I can't remember if it was Plato, but basically. I wonder, like, hearing you talk about that, Hans, if there's sort of like this, like, kind of like room we make for like films to lie to us, and in that lie, we think that there's actually like maybe like a kind of vast like space to investigate, to explore, like what actually, you know, a kind of, I guess, a hidden meaning, whereas text, we expect a kind of a truth. And I'm wondering about that, listening to you talk about this, where like we make different allowances, we look for different things, we hold, you know, written and visual media to sort of different standards when it comes to that kind of, overt mystery that like film in sort of like we allow film to get away with that.
And we maybe take theme, like we allow film to be interesting in ways which make it easy to disregard theme, right? Like when we were talking about, I can't remember what it's called. The Watchers, that terrible Dean Koontz novel, right? One thing that bothered us about one thing we were talking about in relationship to the Watchers was the conservatism of the Watchers, right? And I talked a little bit about the conservatism, or what I saw as being the fairly strong conservatism of Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson. And we reflected on how, with at least for us, for the three of us, there's a way that we're very put off by thematic messages in fiction that we disagree with or find objectionable that we're quite happy to ignore in a lot of film, right? Like, essentially all action movies are in some sense fascist, but what ifs, you know? And I think you're... exactly. I think Die Hard is that's the example that we used, right? And, you know, your point, Chris... Your point that we have the idea in the culture that image lies and text tells the truth, that bias, among other things, I think is probably an expression of that belief. Well, that seems like a good place to end, I guess. Movies are beautiful and they make all our lives more beautiful. Fiction is awesome. Zeroville and Flickr are wonderful books. Book of Illusions may or may not be a wonderful book. And I'm certainly glad I read it. I'm glad I came back to it, right? Like I read it just kind of to have something in front of me 15 years ago and didn't really remember much about it. And I'm glad... I don't know for sure if I like it or don't like it, and I don't know for sure if Paul Auster is a wonderful or terrible writer. I do think that this work at least is deserving of consideration and study, and I'm glad that I did. So Patrick, what's up next?
As a preface to explaining my pick, I want to ask a question. So let's say that I make a statement, and that statement is this: Omen Setter's Luck is a bad novel.
Okay.
I don't think it's a bad novel. I didn't really like it, but I think it's a good novel, but I didn't really like it. But the point is this: can that statement be wrong, or is it? What do you guys think? Do you think that statement can be wrong? Like Omen Setter's Luck either is a bad novel and the statement is correct, or Omen Setter's Luck is a good novel and the statement is incorrect. Or is it only a statement of opinion? What do you think?
I think for complicated reasons, I'm going to say the statement cannot be correct or incorrect, even though I think that's an oversimplification.
That's kind of where I was going. It feels like, I was just thinking about the trolley problem. Right. You know, like in the trolley problem presupposes like you have to make this choice and maybe the moral obligation is to sort of like actually like resist the frame itself. I don't know if that can be true or not true. It's, I think that like it is subjectively true for you. If you believe that, so.
Okay.
I think, yeah, I mean.
So.
I don't think that it can be true or not true at a blanket level, but I also don't think that it's correct to just say that all taste is subjective and everybody's got their own thing and there's nothing to it beyond that.
Okay.
I think that.
So.
Well, yeah, I could go for a while, but
no,
go ahead and tell us your pick.
Well. That basically that topic is what I want to discuss next time, whether or not such statements can be true or not true. And I'm not actually sure what I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually sure whether I think the statement Omen Setter's Luck is a bad novel is correct or just a statement of opinion or somewhere in between. So I've picked out two dense articles of technical philosophy for us to read. One takes the position that such statements can be correct and the other does not, and one is actually responding to the other.
Oh, yeah.
So okay. I really want to talk about that topic. I think together the articles are like 35, 40 pages. You know, it's hard reading, so we're not going to do more than these two. But, I think like it seems like an important question for what we're doing. You know, we're having a podcast where we make aesthetic judgments about novels and artwork and other ideas. So it kind of seems reasonable to devote one episode to just seeing whether, like, is what we're talking about just like just us rambling, or is there something more to it? So that is what I want to talk about. Is
yeah.
that all right.
That sounds interesting.
Sure.
All right, cool.
Should we also watch the movie LFO and use as a test case the question of whether or not it is a good or bad movie?
I would love to do that.
Okay. I'm down for that if you are, Chris.
I'll watch LFO.
Okay. So we'll.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Yeah, we can. That's awesome. Actually, that's actually a good idea, Hans. Like, I know I made jokes about it, but yeah, let's watch LFO, which I'm saying it's a great movie, and like we can test the ideas that we're going to talk about.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you much, everybody, for listening. This has been the Book Spider Podcast, and I hope you all have a great 2 weeks.
Yep. Thank you both.
Before you guys go, so I don't want you to have to, like, I paid for one of the articles. I wasn't able to find it through UAF's library. The other one I was able to find. So how should I share that with you guys? Like, I don't want you guys to have to, like, they're just PDFs. Should, like, we do, like, what is a way that we will not get in trouble for sharing copyrighted material? So just put it in Facebook chat. Like, it's not going to matter. Okay. Sounds good to me. All right. Cool. Well, morally, I think we should, but legally, we would get in trouble. Sure. All right. I'll talk to you guys later then. Peace.